Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 12:13 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time today, and is July 12th. And being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, this week was really particularly eventful because we've seen the S&P 500, the Nasdaq 100, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average pushing on to new all time highs. So I thought I would kick off today and just look at some longer term logarithmic scale charts, because they give us an idea of what's happening in terms of percentage moves. And generally speaking, that is how longer term investors are thinking, because they're not leveraged. They're much more attuned to how much money they're making on a percentage basis. But what I find particularly interesting is that when you look at the long term weekly chart, that in the context of big bull markets, and we can go all the way back and look at the big bull market that started in the, well, really in the early 1980s. It was the 1,000-day or the 200-week moving average represents an area of support during secular bull markets. Well, the moving average right now is at 2,453, and the index is at 3,000, 3,010 in fact. So we have a fairly substantial overextension right now. But what we can also see is that there have been plenty of occasions over the course of the last 40 odd years where there have been very wide overextensions relative to the trend mean. They have generally been unwound. These have been particularly jarring in terms of investor confidence. Usually when you get one of these significant drawdowns, then that is something that gets people all worked up, and they start thinking about the next recession, or really thinking that that a recession is imminent. And they also start to get really worried about a crash. The most visceral experience that people have experienced in the last 20 years has been the global financial crisis. And we can see very clearly, even on the logarithmic scale chart, just how big the pullback was. In fact, this pullback was bigger than the 1987 crash. But there was a much bigger difference between the 87 crash and in 2008. We were still in the broad ranging phase in 2008, and it took us down to a new reaction low. The 1987 crash represented a very, very wide overextension relative to the trend mean, and it was an example of a swift reversion to that mean. It didn't coincide with a recession, and it didn't really coincide with a very marked change in the trend either. The very big pullback we had in the fourth quarter of last year represented a pullback to the mean, and the rebound that we've had subsequently, and then the subsequent finding of support in the region of the trend mean with a large upside weekly key reversal, that was a confirmatory signal that we are at a point now where there is definitely demand started to come back through. We're back in a demand-dominated environment. We're at new recovery highs. Ranges or explosions waiting to happen. The market has just broken on the upside. We can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside as long as the breakout is sustained. And if then this is where analyzing charts becomes really quite easy, because if the breakout is sustained, then we're back in a demand-dominated environment. A consistent trend is a trend in motion. It should continue to range and trend higher with ranges one above another, or at least a progression of higher reaction lows. If it fails to sustain the upward break and the dynamic of the failure is greater than the dynamic of the breakout, then we could be in for a reversion back down towards this long-term mean. We're not sufficiently above this range yet to completely avoid that potential. But we definitely know that in terms of this secular bull market, it's still in action. Now, why are we thinking about a secular bull market? Well, one reason is technological innovation. There have been a number of news stories over the course of the last few weeks about the exponential pace of evolution of quantum computing. We've been conditioned to expect Moore's Law. Moore's Law was the doubling of computing capacity every 18 months. What we're starting to see now with quantum computing is a double doubling. So instead of doubling, we're getting squaring. And therefore, the pace of the advance is exponentially faster than it was before. That means that within 12 months, if the pace of innovation continues, we're going to have a quantum supercomputer. A year after that, there'll be more computing potential in a quantum computer than all of the other computers in the world combined. A year after that, we're going to be talking about almost godlike potential in terms of computing power. That's the pace of exponential growth that is being produced today. Of course, it's hard to put that kind of growth into terms that are easily understandable. And there is obviously a doubt as to whether that pace of innovation can continue or that it is even realizable. But it is an example of the kind of exponential advances we're getting in technology that are independent of the financial cycle. That's perhaps the most important point. But then we have the fact that we're still in a very liquid environment. That if we think about what's going on in terms of central banks, the Federal Reserve is about to cut interest rates. They are going to end their quantitative tightening program in September. Naturally, just by virtue of they continuing to provide enough liquidity to support growth in the economy, the size of their balance sheet will continue to advance at a modest pace as soon as they stop their tightening program. And that is going to provide liquidity for the market. Then we have the fact that the ECB is getting ready to move into negative interest rates. And they already have negative deposit rates, so this is going to move short-term interest rates into negative territory. Right now, we're starting to see that the German Bund, having been the yield trending down in a very persistent manner for most of the last 3 months, has had at least a pause. But if the ECB is in fact going to continue to lower interest rates and potentially even kick off quantitative easing again, then that is going to kick in a substantial amount of additional liquidity into the market. China has got a nascent inflation problem, but they are also running massive fiscal deficits. They have been trying to contain the shadow banking sector. We are now starting to see that the number of defaults is trending higher. It is well above a similar pace from last year. But the bigger picture is that they are trying to offset that contraction in the shadow banking sector and the economic slowdown with a massive fiscal stimulus. It was 500 billion. It was 585 billion last year, and it's likely to be quite similar this year. China ran a trade surplus last month, but not for good reasons. The real reason was that they stopped importing, and that's not a positive factor. That's more about less demand growth in the domestic economy than any other factor. That's one of the most important points, that when we think about the outlook here, well, there is a real potential that China is going to have a growth hiccup, and that's at the very least. One of the things that we can certainly see, and there is a big argument going on right now about the nature of interest rates and the just how distorting very low interest rates and negative interest rates have on asset prices. But What it does create is an urgency. If you are an investor, and I think it is important to differentiate between the actions of investors and traders. If you're an investor, then you're totally reliant on the momentum in the market persisting. And that is only to the extent that you can sell the bond later before it matures. Eventually, somebody is going to end up holding that bond. So the people that are most at risk are yield to maturity investors, like pension funds. Generally speaking, one of the strategies that a pension fund or a trust company or anyone that has got long-term obligations would be coming up with would be to create a bond ladder. And you would meet your obligations through the return of principal and of coupons as various portions of the bond ladder mature over time. But of course, if you're going to take a significant capital loss on the bonds that you're buying, and then bond ladders become a nonsense. Well, then from an investor's perspective, then they have to go look elsewhere. They have to go and buy bonds that are not trading at a negative yield. I think that's one of the most important points behind the significant rally we've had in treasuries or indeed gilts. But on the other side of it is the trader. Well, the trader has no intention of holding to maturity. They are just in this for momentum. They are going to make money hand over fist in this kind of momentum-driven market. So there are two very important differentiators between the kinds of investors that we have out there. Well, there is the real potential here that this significant bull market is about to take another leg higher. We couldn't really say that the secular bull market is over until it sustains a move below this long-term trend mean. Now, that is at least a 20% pullback in terms of where the market is today relative to the trend mean. And of course, if we do get an acceleration up and out of this range, well, then there is obviously a much larger pull-down risk relative to the region of the trend mean. Well, then that would characterize an acceleration. And there is the real potential that we are going to see some acceleration. I thought, though, that it was worthwhile to look at some additional indices over these long-term charts, because especially from a longer-term perspective, Europe has underperformed by a considerable margin in local currency terms. But in US dollar terms, then the underperformance has been, in fact, it was the outperformance of Europe all the way up to the credit crisis, and the subsequent underperformance really does highlight in very stark terms just how difficult a macro environment Europe has, and how dependent it is on the growth of the global economy. And of course, that is where there have been some of the biggest questions. I do think, though, that if we're going to take a longer term perspective, that the potential for the global economy to hit a trough and to start recovering has to be something that is very much on the potential outcomes, for the simple reason that central banks all over the world are lining up to provide additional liquidity. There might be a delayed reaction to that liquidity, but monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. If we have learned one lesson from the global economy over the last decades, that is by far the truest of all statements. When we then think about, for example, the UK, we're provided with a somewhat different environment here. The FTSE 100 in US dollar terms is just about at the 10,000 level, and it is at least pushing back up towards the upper side of this range. When we look at it in local currency terms, the devaluation of the pound has resulted in the index breaking on the upside, and so far this continues to look like a first step above that base. Then when we think about what's going on in Japan, what I find particularly interesting is when we think about Japan over the long term, and then in US dollar terms, well, when we look at it going all the way back to the bubble peak in 1989, we're already at those peaks. The decline in nominal terms has been much greater, but because of the relative strength of the yen over the same time frame, foreign investors have done better in Japan than local currency investors. But the most important point here is that the Nikkei continues to hold the region of this psychological 20,000 level. And the most important thing we've seen over the course of this long bear market is every time it got up to test the upper side of that range, it failed. And then it found support back in 2016, and now it has broken on the upside. Well, we can then conclude simply that as long as it's holding the region of the trend mean, and basically the 1,000-day moving average, then this is still a bull market environment. If it can't do that, well, then that is going to be a different story. That then we would need to certainly reassess. Now, when we look at the A-share index, this hasn't been an index that has really been kind to investors over the course of the last decade. All of the big growth in the market happened in the 1990s. We had a bubbly activity back in 2005 and 2006. In fact, the major decline we had in China was a lead indicator for what happened in the wider economy. And this index looks very range bound. In fact, there is a clear downward bias to trading over the course of the last couple of years. And this long-term moving average has broken. We've now seen that it was offering support in the region of the long-term moving average between 2015 and the beginning of 2018, and now it encountered resistance there. We've been through significant periods in Chinese stock market history when the index has spent quite a long time below this long-term moving average, and we're below it again. What that suggests is it would be rather premature to think that China is going to represent an area of outperformance for global investors for really the foreseeable future. And I think perhaps it is that is sorry, that was still in whoops, that was still in Japanese yen terms. If we look at it in US dollar terms, it's exactly the same story. Well, from an international investor's perspective, this doesn't matter, it because the renminbi has been pegged for so long. When we look at the Nifty in India, then we continue to see that this represents a bull market environment. When we look at it in US dollar terms, we're presented with the same story. What this is particularly important because the Indian rupee has been among the most persistently weak currencies in the world, but it is now starting to strengthen. It is back above its trend mean for the first time in at least 3 or 4 years, and that was a failed upside break last time. But what we can certainly see in terms of the local currency market is that the 1,000-day moving average has been an area of support for at least the last decade. And as long as that remains the case, well, then we're still in a reasonably bull market environment and a consistent trend is still in evidence. Then when we think about Australia, there has been a lot of change in terms of the currency markets over the course of the last while. I think it's appropriate to look at it in local currency terms first. because the ASX 200 is now back in the region of the peak from 2007. And it certainly looks a lot better supported now than it did back then. We saw a very impressive advance in resources market or resources-based markets for the majority of the 2000s, and they just about all peaked in 2007. Since then, we've seen a rather substantial devaluation in the value of the Australian dollar. So that has sapped the potential here, but the index is now pushing back up towards the upper side of this almost decade-long range. What this is beginning to suggest is that we're going to see some markets do better from here. Australia is very strongly correlated with the growth of the global economy. A lot of that growth has been focused on China. But what we're definitely seeing now is that there is a significant transition in terms of the global supply chain, and that is a direct response to the trade war. The long-term ambition. I think, well, one thing I think is quite clear. This is not just about a trade war. This is more about a Cold War. The way that the USA won the last Cold War was through economically bankrupting the USSR. And that may or may not be possible with regard to China, but I think the decision has been made, and it does appear to have cross-party support, is that China needs to be leaned on. China has made very bold statements and made absolutely no secret of their intention to become the global hegemon, to become the most globally significant economy in the world, to become a technology center, to drive its or to become a military power. They have been purchasing resources and rights to resources all over the world. They're building a blue water navy to secure their supply chain, and they are the Belt and Road Initiative is a it is essentially an effort to tie countries to within its ecosystem through debt agreements. Well, all of this is creating a center of gravity outside of the USA, and it is creating a polarized environment. China has made significant inroads into Europe. It's bought ports in Greece. It has got former prime ministers of at least a handful of countries on the payroll. Certainly that's true of David Cameron. It's true of one of the Italian prime ministers. It's true of a number of French officials. And this is all part of the great game. So there is a clear effort underway to try and moderate China's advance. Well, that is going to require infrastructure development in a host of other countries. India could certainly benefit. Vietnam is already at capacity. They need to build quite significant additional manufacturing capacity. And that is likely to occur. The problem for Vietnam is that it has a land border with China, and it has an increasingly a difficult trading environment with China, not least with regard to the ownership of assets in the South China Sea. But in local currency terms, and we are talking about a largely pegged currency, the Vietnamese index is right in the region of the peak from 2007 and has been consolidating for much of the last year and a half. And it is now starting to firm from the region of the 200-day moving average and is still somewhat overextended relative to that 1,000-day moving average. Then if we think about the NASDAQ, which has been a source of outsized growth for a really prolonged period of time, then it has by virtue of its outperformance being the clear leader in terms of US dollar performance. The fact that it spent a year and a half consolidating in the region of the previous peak back between 2005 and 2015 and 16 found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average last year and is now pushing on to new high ground. This continues to represent a very consistent medium-term bull market environment from a non-leveraged investor's perspective. The reactions in terms of the log scale chart have been really quite similar. They've been one above another. We have now got five major reactions, one above another. The distance between these reactions is getting wider, although the size of the move and, in fact, the duration of the move on both of the last uptrends has been quite similar. And if the market can rally by 2,000 points on these advances, and it is now clearing the 7,000 level, well, we would have to at least think that if this trend is going to remain consistent, that the next area of potential resistance is 10,000 points. And we could be there in the next year, or potentially year and a half. Now, that would represent a 25% advance from where the market is today. And that is not a potential outcome that I think most investors are positioned for. The vast majority of investors are positioned for a crash. There is an enormous amount of cash sitting on the sidelines. And that has been a factor of this very significant issue with the yield curve inverting, with people shouting from the rooftops that a recession is imminent, and of course the severity of the pullback that we had in the third quarter. I think there are a number of points that we need to think about. The first is oil prices are not surging higher. Generally speaking, it is when oil is really moving on the upside that we can see a significant deterioration in global growth. So that's certainly one potential outcome. But one thing we can see over the long term is that oil does tend to move in big cycles. And the big cycle lasted between about 1999 and 2008. And the price went from 10 to 150. That's a big move. And it represented a very significant headwind to global growth. Secular bull markets in commodities represent a step higher in the marginal cost of production. And the marginal cost of production back in 1998 was approximately $10 at the nadir, but perhaps more correctly about $25. And $40 in extremis. Well, today we can see that it is the $40 to $30 area has been where, or that is enough of a fall to inhibit supply. And that the vast majority of the new shale properties are economic somewhere between $50 and $55. So we've had a step change in terms of the marginal cost of production. And this is representative of another long-term range. But these ranges in commodity prices can last for decades. What it needs to really represent a step up and out of this range, in other words, a sustained move up and away from $150, would be a good deal of inflation to devalue the value of the dollar, but also a new source of demand. And that new source of demand is not readily realizable. And what that suggests is it's going to be rather difficult for oil prices to sustain moves above $80, not a mind 100 or even $140 to $150. You would need to see a significant supply problem in order to see the price moving substantially higher from here. But the very fact that the price is contained right now, that's not suggesting that we are on the point of seeing growth collapse. That's, I think, one of the most important points. Then, when we think about the yield curve, the 10-year minus 2-year has not become inverted. So this is a let me see now. This is a yield curve chart. When we look at the yield curve on the 10 minus 2 year, which is the classic way of thinking about it from a market's perspective, then the yield curve has not inverted and it popped on the upside in here this week, particularly following the statements from the Federal Reserve. It had given up all of its advance last week and it took it all back again in here this week, a rally of almost 12 basis points. That's representative of support coming through in terms of liquidity provision. I've also created this long-term chart of the total assets of central banks. It's currently sitting at $19.6 trillion. There has been a pretty substantial contraction in the first part of this year, but it found support this week, and it does look like it has broken the downtrend since the beginning of this year. We are starting to see evidence now of some support coming back in terms of central bank liquidity. And that's also a factor in the strength of the dollar. When we think about the long-term outlook for the dollar, well, it has pulled back pretty persistently now over the last 3 days. There is a short-term sequence of lower rally highs, and that's within the broad context of an uptrend over the course of the last couple of years. But the USA does not want to have a strong currency. One of the reasons why they are cutting interest rates today is not so much because the USA urgently needs an interest rate cut. We still have extraordinarily low unemployment. Economic activity is still fine, and the consumer is still in robust health. And the consumer represents the vast majority of the economy. So as long as the consumer is fine and we still have a high employment, then that is a significant factor in the continued outperformance of the US economy. Coupled with the fact that energy prices are contained, and also that we have it, the USA is the center of technological innovation, well, that is helping to create a differentiation. When you look at Europe and Japan, where there is an argument for why their markets should be doing better and why they could do better in future, there's no great urgency. And the fact that you have these negative interest rates and the distorting effect that has on their bond markets, that is a factor in the continued outperformance of the USA. By cutting interest rates, what the USA is in fact doing is providing a stimulus to the global economy. And in doing so, it is aiming to try and give some assistance to the portion of the US economy that is under pressure, which is the export sector. It's also the sectors that are most keenly affected by the trade war, because I do believe it is quite likely that the long-term outcome of the trade war is a differentiation in terms of the economies and a polarization of the global geopolitical environment. The fact that the USA is now energy independent and also has the strength of its domestic economy. What they do not have is the domestic manufacturing capacity. Therefore, it's in their interest to either develop the manufacturing capacity domestically or to develop it in friendly countries internationally. If China is no longer willing to accept that role, or at least to play along, to get along, then other countries will be found that can fulfill that role. Well, India is certainly one of those. It has the young population, it has low wages, and it has a need for jobs. That's obviously the market that ticks the most boxes if they can get their economic and governance wherewithal together. Then India is certainly one of the countries that would benefit. So is East Africa, or countries in East Africa, and Vietnam has already been among the better performers and the prime beneficiaries of this migration. China is going to continue to be a massive manufacturing sector, just not for the USA. Therefore, there is an opportunity. There obviously is for companies that can differentiate their businesses internationally between what they're exporting to the USA and what they're exporting to Europe or Japan, then they can still use China and they'll avail of capacity growth there as a result of US migration away. That is certainly benefiting companies in the garments industry, but it will benefit any of the manufacturers that have previously relied in China but are not active in the USA. The dollar is looking susceptible to additional declines. And if that is the case, then that is positive for gold. So the gold price, firmed in here today in lockstep with the decline in the US dollar. But perhaps the most important point is that it has broken up and out of this 6-year range. And this is one of the clearest base formations we have anywhere, where you have this clear rounding consolidation. Now, I'll be the first to admit, I really did think that we were on the point of breaking out back in 2018, and it took another dip down before it did in fact break out. But what's most particularly interesting about gold is that it is not simply breaking out in US dollars. It is breaking out in a large number of currencies. And I need to put in the correct ticker to get that done. So in Australian dollars, it has broken away from the previous range that persisted for 8 years in rather emphatic fashion. In the Canadian dollar, it is also doing better here and is consolidating in the region of the peak from 2011. In Brazilian real, despite the fact that the real has been reasonably steady over the last few months, it's at new all-time highs. When we look at it in renminbi, it cleared the 9,000 level in the last few weeks, and that was a very significant breakout. Against the pound, it found support in the region of £1,000 and has broken higher. But perhaps the most important thing is that gold is now exhibiting very strong commonality in just about all currencies. In fact, it's against the euro where it has perhaps been lagging, but it has now broken through the resistance at the peak in 2016 and looks like it is going to get back up to the peaks in 2012. Well then, what's particularly interesting at the current moment is the underperformance of silver. It is nowhere near breaking out. It is really just on the cusp of finding support in US dollars. The most important thing that it has done has been to fail to sustain moves below $15 since at least 2014. That's a very meaningful change. It does suggest that $15 is the lower side of this evolving base formation. It's really going to have to break successfully above the sequence of lower rally highs. And that would suggest a move back above the peak that we saw 4 weeks ago. If it can sustain a move above $16, well, then we are clearly breaking the long-term downward bias. Silver had by far the most impressive acceleration in the precious metals sector back in 2010 and 2011, and it has subsequently suffered one of the bigger declines. So it is taking some time, but if gold continues to break upwards, then there is going to be some interest in proxies and potential high beta plays. That's also true of platinum. Platinum has got a very mild sequence of higher reaction lows within this evolving 6-month range, but it is starting to firm from here. One of the major factors in platinum has been the absence of demand from diesel catalytic converters, but the relative difference between platinum and palladium is so wide that substitution is, I think it's inevitable that we're going to get some form of substitution. And palladium got up to $1,600 in here today and is beginning to demonstrate some resistance in here. At least some consolidation is looking likely in the region of the peak from back in March. So when we think about the outlook for gold, there is obviously one very clear reason for why we would have the outperformance of assets that cannot simply be printed into existence. And it's simple enough that with the massive sources of liquidity that are being pumped into this market, then the way that asset prices are being inflated and how growth is being promoted is a broad spectrum effort to devalue the purchasing power of currencies. And negative interest rates are perhaps the clearest evidence of that. When we think about the fact that we are being forced to buy bonds that can't possibly give us a total return in positive terms, that's an appropriation of savings. So it is tantamount to a devaluation of the currency. That's also part of the reason why Bitcoin has been surging higher this year. And this looks like another step in what has so far been a reasonably consistent advance in nominal terms, but particularly on a log scale chart. So this is all representative of this effort by investors to try and protect their purchasing power. Eventually, there is the clear risk here that with valuations where they are and interest rates where they are, that we are going to eventually have a recession. The tightness in liquidity that we've had is, and certainly the 10-year and 3-month spread in Treasury yields that the Fed pays attention to did go negative and stayed negative for a quarter. That suggests that there is the risk of a recession a year from now. Well, there is also the fact that we are in the third year of the US presidential cycle, that you generally do get a growth scare in the first half of the year, and then the Federal Reserve does start to ease, and you get the best performance in the market in the second half of the third year, carrying through to the fourth year. And so far, that the way that the market is evolving is very much in line with that cycle. when we do get the next recession, the clear risks are in the bond markets because of the contradiction that you cannot buy bonds at a negative yield and expect to make money indefinitely from them. You cannot have funds that have got instant liquidity investing in lockups for private assets that stretch into the years. We're already starting to see these kinds of investments blowing up. And if you're China, you cannot decide that you want to become the biggest economy in the world without making some enemies along the way. And this is perhaps one of the greatest examples of institutional hubris in the world. Well, that's where the risks are. But in the meantime, between now and when these actually become urgent risks, well, generally speaking, it is immediately after a yield curve becomes inverted that you do get the acceleration phase. And that is a significant potential right now, that with markets breaking on the upside, and most particularly the outperformance of the subscription business model, which marries the reliability of cash flows similar to bond proxies like consumer staples with the growth of software and technology companies, that is the business model to ignite the interest of investors in this cycle. And that suggests we are going to get an acceleration higher from here, that the clear risk is that we are going to see valuations go from modestly overvalued to silly. And it is when everybody is invested, when the fear of missing out is so powerful that there is no cash on the sidelines, well, then that is when you do have to be particularly interested in top formation development and particularly vigilant in terms of the consistency of trends. But that is probably something to pay attention to next year, and most particularly if the breakouts on Wall Street persist. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.